Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Today, we've got a jam-packed show for you, but I want to get right to it with Congressman Mike Quigley, a Democrat from Illinois' 5th District. Congressman, thanks for taking time. You know, when we first set this up, I thought we might have nothing to talk about. I was wrong. Let's start with the veto just about an hour or two ago by the president of the National Defense Act. Did you see it coming?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, the president announced he was going to do it later once this bill was well to the point of getting passed by an overwhelming measure, 84 to 13 in the Senate, 335 to 78 in the House, and clearly this sets up for a veto override for the first time in this president's four-year term.
So the problem the president has with the National Defense Bill, this is what funds the military, gives the military a raise, is developing armor specifically designed for women in combat. But apparently the president wants provisions in this bill that deal with Rule 230 that has to do with Twitter and rules like that, because they're just not held liable for when things happen and when people say things people aren't happy with. But also he also is upset that there's a provision that says Confederately named bases should be changed for other people. Those two things are enough to keep him from signing it. I think this is also the first time in 59 years that the bill is not automatically signed and passed by those kinds of overwhelming majorities.
Sure. When I get sworn in about a week from now to my 7th term in Congress, our oath begins with the promise to defend the country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. This is the most important thing we do, is keep our country safe. And I think it's instructive for those who would come to the president's defense here that the Republican Senate chairman of the Armed Services Committee said that he agrees with the president's sentiment about 230, but it has nothing to do with the military and doesn't belong in the bill. And both parties have been pretty disciplined about doing that. Because the defense bill is important, and if you throw a lot of other things that are extraneous, and that does happen in bills, it weakens the chance to do this. And we recognize that this is a bill that has to. It's one of the few must-pass bills every year, and it's unfortunate the president's taken up this stance. And we'll see. We'll see if the Republicans who disagree with him on this will show the profiles and courage, and it's probably Monday is set up for a potential veto override vote.
Well, and Kevin McCarthy, I think the leader of the Republicans in the House, apparently wants to side with the president on this. Do you have any fear? Because that would mean Republicans in the House would be going not only against their leader, but against the president. Do you have any fear that that will change things, or will this veto simply, will it be overridden?
I it's a great question. I do believe that the Democrats who supported this will support the override. It's hard to say which Republicans feel that they should have some profiles and courage again and stand up for this. Otherwise, this bill fails, and it can't fail. And what it would mean is that it would have to start all over again in January for a President Biden signature. I'll tell you this, it's not going to be amended to include Section 230. So the president has two choices. This is either overridden, and there is no bill passed for the first time in 60 years.
And what happens? Is funding cut off for the military?
Well, I would suspect we'd have enough time if we would do this immediately under the Biden administration. Again, we get sworn in immediately in January. President-elect gets sworn in 3 weeks later, roughly. And I would imagine, given the support it had, taking out the dispute with the current president, that it would be one of the first things he signs into law. So we look, either override it or the president at that time, President Biden, signs it. So it's going to pass. It's as important a bill as we pass every year. It's either going to be now or in several weeks. But just so you know, the president's not going to get his way. No one's going to put 230 into this. And if they did, it wouldn't pass because of that, because they wouldn't get support across the board.
We'll take a break in about a minute, but I just want to begin the conversation. And by the way, if listeners want to call and actually get to talk to Congressman Mike Quigley, 312-981-7200, because he's gracious enough to stay with us for another segment. Were you surprised last night that after the COVID and the budget bill got passed after so much, you know, haggling, it took so long to get there? Government, I think, is scheduled to shut down now on Sunday night, or so to speak. Were you surprised that the president took to Twitter with a video basically saying this bill is ridiculous?
You know what's most surprising? The things that he specifically objected to when he was doing comparisons, for example, with money spent on foreign policy,
right?
Every item he pointed to that he didn't like was in his budget proposal. We passed two bills, and they were put together. One funded the government for a year. One provided COVID relief. The things he objected to were in the funding bill, and they were also in his budget. So apparently his staff didn't tell him, by the way, these were our proposals.
Yeah, but it rings well with his supporters, right? When he says, what are we spending $83 million for in Romania and these kind of things? You know, people out there who don't know any about what you just said say, yeah, that's not right. We should be putting that in COVID money. But of course, as you said, those were indeed White House requests for the budget. Aside from the fact that the fund the government bill had things that the president actually requested in it and now he's complaining about, which again plays well for his public, I think. But let's talk about the COVID relief. I know Democrats weren't, it wasn't what you wanted. And the president came out and said, let's give everybody $2,000. And Nancy Pelosi couldn't tweet fast enough. I'm on it. I'm there. Let's do it.
That's where we started. And look, talk about strange bedfellows. The president's Fed chief has advocated additional direct assistance. And basically, and the former Fed chiefs of Democrat and Republican have said, you have to go big now. If anyone thinks that we're past the crisis from COVID and from the resulting economic downturn, they're mistaken. And those Fed chiefs have said pretty clearly, you know, if we don't do more, this economy can still crater. It can still collapse. So now's not the time to say, well, it's going to be a Democratic president. We don't want to spend as much money. We've been trying to get $2,000 all along. I'll go tomorrow. Bags packed. You want to vote on it? And here's what will happen. Some news tomorrow. We're going to try to do this in a procedural way by unanimous consent. That means we're in pro forma session. Someone will get up and move to amend the bill to include just what the president wants. Exactly. And if no one objects, it will pass the House. I guarantee you one of the Republicans will object. It will not pass. But, hey, if we have to go back next week, we'll be there. The Democrats will vote this. I haven't seen such unanimity in a long time. So we will call the president's bluff, and we'll see how many Republicans join in. It is, though, fascinating to see how this turn of events in this specific point the president raised for 2000 will affect the Senate races in Georgia.
Well, I was going to ask you, what is the president's strategy? Is it Georgia related? Because really what he's asking for is what Democrats want, not Mitch McConnell probably was, you know, getting to his cell phone to say, Mr. President, what are you doing? Right. I mean, so what do you think the president's strategy is here?
Well, I don't know that the president has strategies. I think it's sort of day by day, whatever sort of pops into his mind. And I don't say that lightly. I say that because if you follow the president's way of communication, which is Twitter, he has said we need to go bigger a couple times, and then he has said that, you know, the opposite, that is discouraging doing something at all about COVID again. So I guess my response would be depending on what the president's mood is that day. As far as strategy, I don't know if he has a strategy to help in Georgia. He's raising a lot of money, but from the sound of it, most of it is staying in his own political coffers, which he can use for a lot of different reasons. If I'm a Republican in Georgia, I'm not particularly pleased with the president right now, and it certainly put Mitch McConnell in a tough spot, and I don't have a lot of sympathy there.
There's a lot of people, of course, waiting for those COVID checks whether $600 or whatever it's going to be. So if this doesn't pass and they don't make that movement, the president can do what's known as a pocket veto. Essentially, the timing is interesting here because he doesn't actually have to veto it. You're so close to the end of this congressional session, as you know, new Congress comes in on January 3rd. it essentially serves as a veto. Would that mean nobody gets checks?
Well, you raise a really good point. And from what I have heard, I don't think the president has the bill yet. You know, this is a process where they correct the text. It goes through the signatures in the Senate and the House. It's formally delivered. You know, if he doesn't get it till tomorrow, which I think is going to be the case, he could sit on it until it becomes a new session, and there would be no opportunity for us to override that veto, and there would be no bill, there'd be no checks. There is a big concern to add to that.
Who pays the price for that?
Well, I think the American people.
No, I know, but politically, but politically.
I think at this point in time, it has to lie with the president because the bill passed. It passed both houses pretty overwhelmingly, and he sat and did nothing, knowing that it would kill the bill. Never mind the fact, let's remember some history. The House Democrats approved a much larger bill in May of $3 trillion, in October of $2 trillion. And, you know, let's remember civics, folks. For those who would suggest, well, you know, they made offers. Offers mean nothing in Washington, D.C. Putting the bill on the floor means something. Passing the bill out of the Senate would have meant something. If they had done that in May, we go to conference, we reach a compromise, people already got their checks. Or October, any other time. And $2,000 would have been great. And all the other measures this does for small businesses, housing security, food security. You've heard about the PPP. There's even measures in there that defend all those concert venues and museums and movie theaters that we treasure so much that are in a risk of going out of business. This bill was a lifeline. If the president vetoes it, this puts it off for some time. No guarantee what happens out of the Senate in January, depending on Georgia. So it puts a lot of people's well-being at risk. And frankly, doing all this puts our nation at risk. All this is happening during a pandemic, in a week in which this country has gotten news that has the worst cyber attack in our nation's history, which in and of itself will threaten our nation's security and its economy at the same time.
Yeah, that was on my list. We're not going to get to that one today. Just for the sake of time, we do have callers, but I'm going to just go ahead and speak. I hope he doesn't mind, but Dale is calling in. He said, you know, he wanted to make a comment. Why is it that people who have full-time jobs, why are they getting money from the government? Shouldn't it be people who are unemployed and suffering?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's a good point. I think what you want to do is take care of those first and most who are unemployed in their entirety, right? The people who are facing, as we are seeing, you've seen the lines at Lakeview Shelter and many, many others all across the region. They're disheartening. They're scary. A lot of people facing evictions, the heartache of not being able to work. On the other hand, the notion of a stimulus check is in addition to that, and that is that most people use that money to buy groceries. Yeah. But there's also money there that would stimulate the economy at its worst possible time, and there's value in doing that as well.
All right. Hope Dale appreciates that. So only about a minute left, Congressman, but I got to get a comment on pardons. I know you weren't happy with the 15 pardons and the 4 or 5 commutations issued last night. The rumors have it there may be more today. The president has absolute power.
Yes. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. The pattern here is that almost all have a personal or political connection to the president. And I think the worst to come will be the president potentially pardoning himself. This ought to repulse and scare anyone there. It's the act of an autocrat. As you know, the founding fathers had just thrown off the yoke of an oppressive king. It is impossible for me to believe that they had in mind the fact that the president would be above the law, or that the president could act as his own judge. The fundamental point here is the Constitution wasn't written with this president in mind, and we're going to have to fill in the blanks. We're going to have to make it specific So this sort of thing can't happen in the future.
All right. We also didn't get a chance to talk about legislation that you and your colleague, Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, are putting in regarding protecting presidential records. I'll encourage people to go to your website and see all that you are doing. Thanks for your time. There's just so much breaking news happened from last night to today that it's unbelievable. Congressman Mike Quigley, Illinois 5th District. Thank you, sir. Have a fantastic holiday. You, your family.
Be safe, everyone.
All right. Thank you so much. Stay safe. We kick off this hour looking at Washington and all that's going on in this country. It's been difficult. So I wanted to check in with Congressman Brad Schneider of Illinois' 10th District, who has been out there taking the votes and doing what he needs to do. Congressman, happy holidays to you and welcome to Chicago Afternoon News.
Hi, Paul. Happy holidays to you. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much. So we all know that the stimulus package, babble when I say stimulus, because would you say what you guys passed was a stimulus package, or would you say this was a rescue package for America?
I think that's a good distinction to make. This is a down payment on a rescue package. You know, it's $900 billion. It's the second largest relief bill ever passed, the largest being the CARES Act back in March. But it is not sufficient to address all the needs we have in this crisis. The COVID pandemic's created a health crisis and an economic crisis. People are struggling. They're out of work. They're suffering from food insecurity. Lines at food banks are incredibly long. This is a down payment. It'll carry us through the next couple of months. And so I was glad we got it through, but we've got far more work still to do.
I agree with you. And, you know, look, I'm sure people will be happy to get their $600 check per person. And if they've got a couple of kids under the age of 18, they'll get another $600 per kid. So it can add up to some money. But I was looking at, like, you know, listen, I don't have to tell you what rents are in the city of Chicago. Even a one bedroom apartment in Oklahoma City is still, like, I think it was $1,650, something like that. So did your colleagues in Congress look at this? I mean, is the thought that, yes, we will get people through Christmas, they'll be fine? Or is it that, no, this is just something, but even this doesn't get us out of a jam, even in the short term?
Yeah, I think the feeling was this is something. Look, the House, the Democrats in the House passed the HEROES Act back in May on the heels of the CARES Act, recognizing that the need was grave. That was $3.2 trillion. At the time, we didn't think it was the final number. We said that. This was a list of priorities. But the Senate just didn't engage. And, you know, by the time we got to the fall, House passed a second version of the HEROES Act at $2 trillion, still too big for the Senate. In fact, they were shrinking what they offered. And that's where the Problem Solvers Caucus, this group that I helped create 4 years ago, it was members of the Problem Solvers Caucus who sat down and said, we have to do something. And a parallel group in the bipartisan group in the Senate worked on a package, and we came out with a proposal at $908 billion. It was a little bit of what we needed, but it was what we could get the Senate to agree to. So that was the starting point. It started with the problem solvers, picked up in the Senate, and ultimately it made it to Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, and the administration. And so this is, it's better than nothing, but we know we have a whole lot more still to do.
One of the key points, I think, is the extension of the eviction provision. People who haven't been able to pay their rent are now protected for another month. But one of the things I've always been curious about, and I don't know if there's a provision. So that does help the tenant, and tenants need that help. But if you're a landlord or you own the building, you still have to pay your mortgage payment. Are the landlords and the owners still in trouble, or is there a moratorium of some sort for them as well?
There's not a moratorium. One thought is that the landlords can apply for forgivable PPP loans. That might help them out. The idea was that the facilities from the Federal Reserve might be available for the commercial landlords. But this doesn't give them the relief that they need. Again, the most important thing we have to do is get this pandemic behind us so that people can get to work and pay their bills, and the people who rely on those bills being paid can pay their bills. And until we do that, there's going to be gaps in all of this.
And a part of this passing was the extra pressure on Congress, because you had the government about ready to shut down. You had till Sunday night, or one more extension would have to be taken. Does it seem to you, like it does to me, that always seems to be what it takes Congress to act? It has to be, we're about ready to shut the doors, and then everybody wakes up. This isn't a comment about you. I mean, this is more about leadership, because that's who makes the decisions.
This is a comment about people willing to put the needs of the country behind their own personal wants or desires. And I've seen this since I came to Congress. I was first elected and came to Congress in 2013. In that September, the Republicans shut down the Congress, and we had 16 days of shutdown. This freshman class that came in was elected in 2018. Congress had shut down at the end of 2018. It was the longest shutdown in history, and this was President Trump's shutdown. So we've seen that, and it's just frustrating because the way it should work, House and Senate should be able to find a compromise to pass the spending bills. That should be done, in theory, by the end of June, mid-July at the latest, so that we've laid out the plans and can get the government funded beginning in the fiscal year that starts October 1. The House passed 96% of the funding in June of this year. The Senate didn't even begin talking about it until the end of September, early October. So it's incredibly frustrating, and it makes it difficult for our military, for the people providing life-saving programs to plan and get it done. We need to change the way it happens.
And we got to take a break in a moment, but I do want to ask you this. It looks as though clearly the Democrats had trouble getting Republicans to accept the money for state and local governments. The Republicans saying you're just trying to bail out states. In Illinois, we understand what they might be referring to. Would the better sales pitch have been, no, this is also about paying for firemen and first responders. That's what that money is for. I don't know if that argument got sold strongly.
It didn't get sold, but that was the sales pitch. This is what our local governments provide, our police, our firefighters, the streets and sanitation to make sure the water we drink is safe and that our sewage water is treated properly to keep us healthy. All of these things are part of local government and are under grave duress because of this pandemic, whether it's a reduction in sales tax revenues or just an increase of expenses for PP&E. And we should be providing relief irrespective of whether it's a red state or a blue state. Our local governments need this help, and I was very disappointed that the Republicans refused to provide that assistance.
All right, we're going to take Congressman, are you still in Washington, or have you made it home yet?
No, I'm in Chicago.
Okay, so that means I know you're wondering what the traffic is like, and so I'm going to give you an answer to that question. We're going to take a quick break.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know, because I know you're planning to come over here, so I want you to know what you're in for. If you want to talk to Congressman Brad Schneider, 312-981-7200, why is so much money going overseas instead of to our citizens who really need it?
Great question, and Paul, I think you're right. So two things passed last night. The omnibus spending bill, which is the budget for fiscal year 2021, as I mentioned, that started on October 1st and had been extended several times until we got to passing it last night. And that was packaged with the relief bill. So the spending bill is what keeps the government operating on a day-to-day basis, passing every year. And it just was delayed this year by a couple of months, as I mentioned, because the Senate didn't pick up the appropriations bills. The relief bill is what we're doing to provide the relief separate from the standard operations of the government to help people who are struggling. And so the two bills went at the same time, but they were separate and distinct. And what the relief bill is the bill that provided the extension on unemployment insurance. It provides the PPP loans, the funding for schools, and $82 billion for schools and universities, but also $10 billion for child care. That is the relief bill. And that is the down payment of what we're going to need to invest more in as we look forward to ultimately getting the virus behind us.
You know, the other thing sitting on the president's desk, you and the Senate passed with veto-proof majorities the National Defense Bill, the one that funds the military, gives raises to the military, creates armor for women in the military. The president has said now he's going to veto it because he's having a trouble with Rule 230, which has to do with Twitter and Facebook and some of those things, and a couple of other provisions. Then you had Kevin McCarthy come out and say, well, he might not challenge the president. If the president actually vetoes the bill that funds the military, you know more than we do, will it get overridden, or do you think Republicans might fall in line and stand with the president on that, not funding the military?
Yeah, I can't speak for Kevin McCarthy, but the National Defense Authorization Act is the bill every year for the last 59 years. It has passed the House and the Senate with broad bipartisan support, and it's signed by the President of the United States, understanding the importance of our military, the importance to invest in our troops, the importance to ensure that they have the resources necessary to defend and secure our nation. So it would be grossly irresponsible for the president to veto this. And I have to believe this passed overwhelmingly in both the House and the Senate with veto-proof majorities, that if the president were to decide to veto this, that both the Republicans and Democrats would put our national security and our troops first and override the president's veto.
All right. Again, so much to talk to you about, but I do want to have Mike. He's calling from Hammond, Indiana, and he wants to talk to you. He must be a senior citizen. He has a question about funding for them. Hey, Mike.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Okay, real good. I'm a senior citizen. I haven't filed taxes for the last 3 years. How long will it take for me to get my stimulus check? Because last time it took about 5 weeks.
Yeah, so that what the Treasury Department is promising is that they'll do a better job this time getting the checks out. It took 17 days to get the checks, the first checks out, and I think more than 10 weeks to get all the checks out. And even then, there's still people who are waiting on their payments from the government. What Secretary Mnuchin has said is that if the president signs this bill, which I believe he did or will today, that checks can go out as early as next week. And that because they have hopefully learned from their mistakes, that it will take less time to get you the money you need.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And sure thing. Congressman, and good luck and Happy New Year.
And Congressman, let me ask you, if the Democrats win the Georgia Senate races, and that means the Democrats will control the Senate, I think you can with confidence talk to me about the relief that will be coming in 2021, both in terms of more stimulus checks and all sorts of funding. If the Democrats don't take those two seats, and, you know, it's Georgia, I mean, those are tough races. What should Americans or your citizens in the 10th district around Illinois, what should we prepare for if the Senate is continued to be controlled by Republicans and the Democrats, you know, make efforts for funding? Will they meet resistance or will things be different in 2021 under President Biden?
Yeah, we'll have to see. Let me take the question maybe in a slightly different direction.
Sure.
What the residents of Illinois should demand and the country should demand is that Congress put aside the partisanship and start doing the work we need to do on behalf of the country. I'm part of the Problem Solvers Caucus that's getting a lot of press now for the work we did on getting this relief bill across the finish line. This is 25 Democrats and 25 Republicans who sit down, work with each other, try to come up with solutions to the challenges we face. The House has passed hundreds of bills this Congress that will end on January 3rd, and they end up sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk and going nowhere. He described himself, these are his words, not mine. He said he's the Grim Reaper, making sure that House bills go to the legislative graveyard. We need Republicans and Democrats to sit down, roll up their sleeves, and work together, and I think people across the country are starting to demand that. And my hope is, and you've seen this with the president-elect Biden, he has said he's going to work with Democrats and Republicans, and he's going to try to find a way to address the challenges confronting us, first with the pandemic, so we can get our economy on the road to recovery, and then infrastructure and other things, climate change, et cetera, so we can renew our economy, get people back to work, and ensure that our best days lie ahead of us.
I did want to get your take. We have just a couple of minutes left on this hack by, well, it appears to be Russia. I mean, so Secretary of State Pompeo, Bill Barr, the Attorney General, the intelligence sources all say Russia. The president says, no, it might very well be China. But what is your take? You're in Congress. How bad is it? It sounds pretty bad.
Yeah, so I'll give you three quick comments on it. Number one, this is really serious, and we should not be lulled into thinking that it's just another cyber attack. This is unlike anything we've ever seen. It was an attack on our government. It was an attack on our infrastructure. It was an attack on American corporations. And I don't think we yet know the full extent of the attack or the implications and ramifications down the road because of this attack. So, you know, by all accounts, it is Russia. Our intelligence community is pointing to Russia. As you mentioned, Secretary of State Pompeo, Attorney General William Barr has said it's Russia. And we need to make sure Russia pays the price, that this attack doesn't go without I would argue, disproportionate response, that anyone who wants to attack or threaten the United States understands that there's going to be a cost to it. And my third point is, it's just very disappointing. We've seen this president refuse to criticize Russia, whether it was stories of Vladimir Putin putting bounties on American troops, or the assassination attempt of Putin's rival Navalny, or now we see with this attack by Russia on the cyber attack, the president just refuses to ever say anything negative against Russia, and that should concern all of us.
Yeah, Congressman, I wish I had another hour to talk to you, but, you know, you've heard the traffic report. It's going to be tough. No, I'm kidding. Anyway, I thank you for your time. I wish you and your family an absolutely wonderful. We just got to get out of 2020. So let's have a wonderful 2021 for all of us. Thank you for the service, and we'll talk to you soon. Congressman Brad Schneider, Illinois 10th District. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Paul. Wishing all your listeners a Merry Christmas and everyone a very happy and healthy 2021.
We are looking forward to that. Thank you, sir. We're going to take a look at what's going on in Springfield and also in the city of Chicago. Joining me is Illinois State Representative Cam Buckner of the 26th District. He's also the newly elected chair of the Illinois House Black Caucus. Representative, I've always known you were part of the 26th District, but I took a closer look at what that represents. Man, is that diverse. I'm going to read Bronzeville, Douglas, Downtown, the Gold Coast, Hyde Park, Kenwood, Near South Side, River North, South Shore, Woodlawn. That's not even all of it. How do you represent that diversity of views in Springfield?
Well, Paul, it is indeed the most diverse district in the Illinois House of Representatives. You know, we've got neighborhoods like Washington Park, who have been plagued by violence and disinvestment for years. And then we have places like Streeterville, who have, really been able to thrive and flourish. What it forces upon me, which I appreciate, is to be a very balanced, a very intentional legislator. It means to talk to all the constituencies with an open mind. But there are a bunch of varying ideas and beliefs and demographics in the 26th district.
And by the way, if listeners want to ask Representative Buckner a question, you can call in 312-981-7200, or you can text at that number as well, because he's going to stay with me till the top of the hour. Representative, we've got to start with the Anjanette Young case. I mean, that was just kind of came out of nowhere in terms of my agenda and what I wanted to talk to you about. But we've all seen that videotape of several cops, I'll just say, breaking into the home of Miss Young. They're in the wrong house looking for her. She's naked. They're handcuffing her, handled very poorly. But at the same time, the Illinois House Black Caucus, these are the kinds of issues you've been wanting to tackle. And Ms. Young may give you exactly what you need to make some things happen, because I don't know anybody who thinks that was handled properly.
Yeah, Paul, the situation that happened with Ms. Anjanette Young was one that was extremely unfortunate. I think all of us watched with all, but for many people, it wasn't shocking. It was a part of a pattern and practice that has been the modus operandi of law enforcement in this town for a very long time. And I think, you know, as we talk about policy and legislation that the Black Caucus has put forth, that many of the members have put forth independently, many times we've been told that the agenda was too radical or too progressive and not fair. You know, this is not about political correctness. It's just about good old-fashioned correctness. And as we continue to try to build a better city through the work that we do, we've got to be cognizant of the fact that we can't continue to operate at the same cadence. And I know a lot of folks are talking about the fact that the Corporation Council decided to step down. But I'll tell you this, Paul, I don't know many of the 2.6 million people who live in this great city who knew or even cared who Mark Fleshner was 7 days ago. For most of the residents, it's not important who is at the table. What matters is what's on the table. And there needs to be fairness and transparency and for people to be able to feel safe in their own homes.
You appeared last week on my WGN-TV political report show on Sunday morning. And at that point, we did not know yet that the Corporation Council was going to. We know he resigned. I think it's pretty clear that the mayor asked for his resignation. Do we expect more heads to roll? I mean, as you just observed this from Springfield, but if you observed this going on, you know, look, even the mayor says she's owned it. There, I believe, is some evidence. I think she's acknowledged she knew about this before. Who pays the political price here, knowing that the goal is to make sure this kind of thing never happens again?
I think everybody has to. Everybody has a role to play, and everybody has a price to pay for when things like this happen. We can change laws in Springfield. We can change the people who are actually executing the laws. We can change protocol. But what this comes down to is humanity and making sure that people are doing the right thing by each other. This is also a culture issue. This is a culture that we have to cut right through the middle of. You can't go around it. You can't go under it. You can't go over it. You got to go straight through it and run to the fire on this and talk about the legacy of lies, the legacy of travesty that have led us to this point. You know, I think that if you can change the players all you want, but if the game remains the same, then the results remain the same. And so we've got to look inside and be, once again, purposeful and intentional about how we move the city forward.
Talk about the relationship on this issue anyway between Springfield and Chicago, because there's a lot of people that would say, look, this is the mayor owns this. This has got to get fixed in the city of Chicago. Springfield, you can, you know, make some programs and policies and try and make life better, but this just isn't your problem. Is this your problem, too?
I think it's all of our problem. And what I'll say about that, Paul, is that we have to do a better job of coordinating across different levels and sectors of government. We do not do a good enough job of that, and that is no one person's fault in particular. I think that albatross hangs around all of our necks because we know the things that we pass in Springfield end up being executed here at the city level, and we need to have some connectivity and a bridge there so that the work that we're doing there is actually aligning with the things that are going to hit the ground here in the city and wherever it hits.
And out of curiosity, has there been contact between you and the mayor on this issue? Because you are the chair of the Illinois House Black Caucus. Will there be contact between the two of you, or is this something the mayor would say, you know, thanks, Cam, I got this?
Yeah, so I haven't personally spoken to the mayor about this. I would welcome a conversation, and I would hope that, you know, as we look at the things that are important to the Black Caucus, moving us forward throughout this new decade and the ones that will follow it, that we can have open and transparent conversation between the levels of government.
Hey, let's just spend a minute or two on the Speaker Madigan situation, because here's the thing, Representative. I don't know that he's ever had the kind of challenge in the past, not since his power has been what it is, that he seems to be facing this year, seems to be six votes short. Lots of pressure on him. The governor has said, speak up, but, you know, maybe you should step down. I mean, everybody's really putting pressure on him, the mayor, everybody. And then the Black Caucus, the House Black Caucus, endorses him. What happened? I mean, can you explain that?
Yeah, and thank you for that question, Paul. The House Black Caucus had a candidate forum a few weeks ago where we invited everybody who was interested in throwing their hat in the ring for the position of Speaker of the House in the 102nd General Assembly to come speak with us, to lay out their priorities, and to let us know how they would help us get our priorities passed. There were only two people who stepped out who announced their candidacy for Speaker. And after the process and a bunch of meetings back and forth within the caucus made the decision as a group that it would be most advantageous for the pillars that the Black Caucus is trying to pass in this, the lame duck session and in the following General Assembly to retain the Speaker. What I do also want to say, Paul, is that, you know, I am of the mindset that whatever happens on January 13th when this new General Assembly is sworn in and we actually have to take a vote, we do not need a prolonged battle. We do not need a protracted fight. We do not need a Pyrrhic victory once we get that over. We know that in 1975, the race for Speaker went 93 rounds and it lasted a number of weeks. What happens if that is the case is that government in this state comes to a standstill. We cannot call any bills out of committee. We cannot discuss anything on the floor. Nothing can happen in the House of Representatives until we can find a person who can get 60 votes to be Speaker. What concerns me about that is that many parts of the state, they're still reeling from the 793-day budget impasse that happened under the Rauner administration. And we've got some really tough days ahead of us. And government coming to a standstill is not helpful. So if that's the case, there'll be no relief for people who live in the forgotten corners of the state. It means that we can't do anything to strengthen our schools, to make sure they're fully and equitably funded. It means that we can't address the coming foreclosure and eviction crisis. It means that we can't put parameters in place to strengthen our healthcare delivery system. So people can make this about Mike Madigan all they want, but to me, this is about the single mother in South Shore or the widow in Streeterville or the student in Woodline or the small business owner in River North. That's who I work for, and that's who I represent when I go to Springfield. And so for those folks, we need to get back to work as soon as possible.
So I totally get what you're saying, but and I know it becomes a partisan thing when a Republican would hear what you say and said, look, Representative, what you're saying is let's just turn a blind eye to everything the Speaker at least is accused of doing. He's indicted for nothing. So, but at least accused of doing. We had this House committee, a commission that looked at it. They wrapped things up after a couple of meetings. And some Republicans said, you know, there is more to those. They didn't just have to expel him or do something like that. There are so many different steps they could have taken to just at least speak out about what he's accused of. The point is, while you're trying to get work done, and you should, Does it make sense to, I'll use the phrase, turn a blind eye to everything that at least is in the news that people are seeing as though it's just not happening because the agenda is too heavy?
No, and I respect that point of view. I don't for 1 minute think that a blind eye is being turned to anything. For those of my colleagues who want to use that line of narrative to you know, kind of blow up the work that we need to be doing, I'm an attorney just like you are, Paul, and we know that the feds almost always get their man, right? And none of the folks who are in the body are charged with actually running the federal investigation or indicting anybody, right? So there have been people that have been indicted that were part of the emails that came out in the special investigatory committee. And I think that we should let the process play out from a legal standpoint.
So let me just have this interesting question to ask you. Let's just pretend for a moment that whether the speaker is indicted or for whatever reason, he has to step down. All right. We're not going to put any definition to it. My question is, then you're forced to have a new speaker. Who would that be? Who would even be? The reason I'm saying that is because right now you've made it clear there's like nobody on the radar except Madigan. Well, if for any reason Madigan were to step down, step out, who would you turn to?
You know, I don't know if the actual person, if I have a name that makes sense, but I know that I have a number of priorities that would be important to me on whoever the person would be. And those actually are the same priorities that are important to me in the questions that the caucus and I asked Mike Madigan. It's about the protection of districts on the map. It's the question about making sure that the economic priorities, the criminal justice priorities, the healthcare priorities of the Black caucus are at the forefront. You know, we are fighting a battle right now, just a stone's throw from my home where I'm speaking to you from, where Mercy Hospital is potentially closing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's an anchor in the community. These are the things that whoever is the Speaker of the House, whether it be Mike Madigan or Paul Lisnick, that person has to be able to address those things in a way that convinces myself and I think many of my colleagues that we can trust that person will help us get these things done.
I hadn't thought about being speaker, but let me mull that over.
I heard it's not a bad job.
Yeah. Some perks. You get to eat an apple every day for lunch. I know that. Hey, I do a quick budget question for you before we lose time on this. You know, your district is all in the city, and we know that the city had to take dire steps. Taxes are going up and all of that. Governor Pritzker and the lieutenant governor have warned us to brace ourselves. It doesn't look like how much are we going to get hit on the state level as well? And do you take into account the fact that, you know, for the Chicago district, we're already getting hit with other taxes and such because of the COVID losses?
Yeah, so the budget is going to be difficult. This is going to be a very precarious situation for us financially, which is part of the reason I keep saying we need to get back to work. No matter what we do, we've got to balance the budget. And Governor Pritzker has said that. He's also talked about things like furloughs and actual cuts within the state budget. Cutting a state budget can never just be an exercise in economics. It has to be a holistic exercise. We haven't only run a budget deficit, but we've run a priority deficit, which has exacerbated our budget deficit. It's going to be tough for Chicago. And what we know from the stimulus package or lack thereof that just came from the federal government is that, you know, Mitch McConnell insisted on not including aid for state and local government.
Oh, yeah, we know that's problematic. I got 30 seconds left, but I did want to ask you, was it a mistake for the budget to be created with the assumption that the graduated income tax would pass and there'd be extra money?
I think so. I think there were better ways to approach it, but we can't, shoulda, coulda, woulda. I think we've got to move forward now and figure out what to do.
And that's what you go back in January to do. You got a lot on your plate, Representative, I got to tell you.
We got work to do, man. We got work to do.
Well, for now, I'm going to wish you, State Representative Cam Buckner, the 26th District, a very wonderful and blessed Christmas and New Year's. Take a deep breath because starting in January, you ain't going to have too much time to take some deep breaths. You got work to do.
Thanks, Paul. Happy holidays to you and your family, to everybody that's listening.
I appreciate it so much, and so do our listeners. Let's turn to the city of Chicago, and so much going on, and with budget issues and a lot of other things, and I wanted to talk to one of the most powerful aldermen on the city council, and if you're looking for that person, you're looking for the chair of the finance committee, and we got him. So joining me now here on WGN 720 is Alderman Scott Wagaspak. He's alderman of the 32nd Ward, but he is chair of the finance committee. That means he knows everything budget. Alderman, welcome to WGN Radio.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Sure.
There's 49 other aldermen, though, so I'm pretty equal to all of them.
Well, I'll say the same thing when I have each of them on, too, if that makes you feel any better. No, I won't. So, Alderman, and by the way, people want to ask Alderman Wagaspak a question, 312-981-7200. You know, I do want to start with the news of the day, which, of course, is just all the headlines. And it was the entry of the police officers into Anjanette Young's apartment. They were in the wrong apartment, looking for somebody in the wrong place. It's just been it's been a PR disaster for sure, I think, maybe for the mayor, maybe for the city. What is your take on it, and what needs to happen? Sir, I give the mayor credit. She said she owns it, and she's going to fix it. What is your take?
Well, first of all, it's just a horrendous police incident that showed complete lack of respect for this woman and for the whole process, and especially by the city lawyers that were involved as well. And I think that's really hard to come back from. And that's why a couple of these attorneys had to quit. I think they quit before they were fired, and that's appropriate. But we're still in committee actually right now, discussing this with the superintendent. We have the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Unfortunately, Cook County judges did not show up, the ones involved in search warrants, or any representative, but same with the law department. But we're trying to figure out a way here to change a system that some of us have been not only talking about, but introducing legislation to change for quite some time.
And I would think, you know, and as you know, at the state level, the Black Caucus has a 4-point agenda that they're tackling. I mean, I have a feeling that this incident is going to breathe new life into the efforts of the notion of systemic racism and the way in which people are treated on the West Side, the South Side. I imagine that's going to happen on the city level.
It is, and I think we were all glad to see that the Legislative Black Caucus came up with that agenda. I think some of us were looking for help from the state for some time to say, you know, what involvement can you have here, and what can you do to help out the situation that we find ourselves in? Because a lot of the laws that need to change are actually state laws. There's some things, as you know, the city can't do without changing the rules at the state. But as far as search warrants, in this case with Anjanette Young, that is definitely something that the police department and the law department have not undertaken an effort until more recently to change. And as you know from settlements that we see in the Committee on Finance, we've been trying to make things much more transparent than I've seen since I've been in office, putting more information out there. But even with that, we need to significantly change the system. And I think every alderman is arguing for that today.
Any word back to you about the response from the police union or police officers in general? Are they equally sort of appalled at what happened, or are you getting some resistance back from the incident?
No, I've heard from several officers in our districts that said that they were appalled at what happened. I think there was a lack of supervision, but also just a complete lack of respect and judgment by those officers that were there after they realized the mistake within the first few seconds. You know, they should have made changes to what they were doing. But, you know, and this isn't the first time we've seen this. We've had search warrants that were put in place in the past that we've settled for, and that's going to happen with this one as well. So the superintendent, Brown, the new superintendent, you know, over the last year or so, he's committed to making those changes. There have been changes on paper, but that has to happen with the judgment of the people walking into those places.
And there's a lot of budget news that I want to talk to you about. We'll do that after the break. But before we go to a break, I did just want to ask you about this. There seems to be an incredible amount of identity fraud going on. I mean, I'm going to be honest. It happened to me recently. And you, what is this the sign of the economic times we're in, or is it just easier to do it? What do you think is leading to all of this?
Well, I think part of it is the data breaches, and we've seen these data breaches locally. We've seen them at the national level. But if you remember back in the housing fraud era, when the housing market crashed, there was a lot of mortgage fraud there, too. And people were able to commit that because we didn't have the systems in place. And I'm wondering what the Illinois Department of Employment is going to do here to change their system, because they've had, I think it was over 200,000 cases just from March, and that was a month ago, so it's probably well above that.
And there's so many steps that if this has happened to any of our listeners, you know, it's not a matter of it just happens. And, you know, you've got to inform the government that it was fraudulent. But I'm a member of one of those companies that kind of protects your identity. Right. And so I got a phone call from them saying you've got to go to just a whole list of websites and reporting entities that you need to tell happen, including credit reports, because who knows what else they're doing when they have this information about you personally.
Yeah, I went to identitytheft.gov and, you know, several of us got hit with it. But that was a good spot to go to check out that list and make sure that you follow through on each one of those. It's time consuming, but the criminals are out there doing this stuff and they're not going to quit as long as they have information from those data breaches.
Alderman, as I mentioned, you are chair of the Finance Committee. We all knew that we were going to take a hit from COVID-19 in the budget. We did. The mayor has a budget. Looks like our property taxes are going to go up. There was some resistance to that. And what was your sense? Did she do the right thing? Was there anything that should not have been that wasn't done in this fix that you would have called for?
Well, I think there were a lot of people that wanted to see a lot more taxes introduced, and some of us pushed back on that because of the impact that COVID has had on a lot of our small businesses, our hotels, a lot of industries in Chicago that now are either closed up or really just hanging on by their fingernails. So I think there was a really good balance here in the way they did things. You know, we are hoping to see more funding coming from the federal government to fill some of these budget holes. And, you know, we saw today that CPS, I think, got $720 million. But every city out there is really trying to find ways to close those budget gaps and looking to the federal government for help, hopefully in the new year.
It's been so tough for businesses and small businesses. You have a lot of them in your 32nd ward. I'm certainly up there a lot and in so many wards around the city. And of course, we have this problem throughout the state, actually, but also I think in Chicago, businesses that don't want to follow the rules. I won't put you on the spot by the difficult situation one of your colleagues, Alderman Tom Tunney, found himself in when he was letting some people eat inside his restaurant. He apologized for it, said it'll never happen again, and that's fine. But for me, it just goes to show the desperation of this situation. That even people who know what's right and know better, they're very worried about their businesses.
Yeah, I think and we have to be more flexible in city government, and I think we tried to do that over the last several weeks. A lot of us pushed for really streamlining permits, reducing the price of permits, allowing businesses to try to do things that haven't been done before. And I do have a lot of great businesses, and they've all been very helpful and just, you know, helping us determine what are those little things that they need or some of the big things overall, and really just moving them as quickly as we could. So hopefully what that does is show us that there's a better way to operate as we come out of the COVID pandemic as well.
Do you have a fear that when all is said and done, we're going to lose a lot of those small mom and pop businesses that just characterize our communities and get left with a lot of, with all due respect to them, but sort of big box stores that may be able to afford to weather the storm? That would be a loss for this city.
Yeah, it'd be a huge loss because small businesses and the people that work in them are restaurant workers, small business owners and workers. They're really the backbone of the city. And, you know, they provide that neighborhood feel. They provide the neighborhood, you know, the type of revenue generation, but also just quality of life that we really need in every neighborhood in the city.
You know, one of the things, of course, that Congress extends is the moratorium on evictions. But what are you hearing from your constituents with regard to people who can't pay their rents? And the flip side to that, the landlords and the owners of buildings, they also have to make payments on their mortgages. And yet, you know, they're not getting rent sometimes. And we're protecting the tenants, which is a very important thing to do. But landlords are in a tough position, too.
Yeah, you know, the mayor tried to work on that at the beginning, talking to the mortgage companies, talking to the landlords and to the and tenants across the board. And I think we need to do a better job, not only from the national level, but all the way down to the local level about how we really try to work together collaboratively on that. I think more of the banks and the lenders need to be at the table. Because, yeah, without the tenants, the landlords can't pay those taxes. We've been working with Fritz Kagi. Fritz Kagi's office has gone through and made a lot of reduction on properties, you know, with a COVID-type reduction. And I think that's going to have to continue through the end of this upcoming year.
So let me turn you into a property tax expert with this question. And what it is this. Everybody, because you're right, Kagi, we got, notes, letters from Kagi, and it looks like he's readjusting things, and I got a letter in the mail showing me that the adjusted value of my home is less than it was. They're making adjustments for this COVID situation. That was great. But then I was talking to my property tax guy who said, well, that may be coming down, but the city still needs to get what it's going to get. So overall, your property taxes in the end, through the adjustment of various other parts of the formula, you ain't going to get a break. It's going to be where it was. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, I think, part of what this budget did have was a levy increase of $94 million. Now, a lot of that, about $16 million, is new developments, new houses that went up. And there's going to be a 1% increase, roughly, for every property in the city. And I think, the mayor came out and said, instead of hitting everybody with a $500 million bill here every couple of years, let's do it and ease it in. That is part of the increase, but I think the other portion, except for the senior freeze, but the other portion is looking at the way the assessor's office calculates all that. And I can't profess to know all that formula. I think you have to really look at it closely as you're determining your numbers, and that's probably why you hired a property tax consultant. Mm-hmm. But it is going to even out for some businesses, our property owners, and I think it's going to help others. So I'm not sure if it's going to be a total wash for everybody, but that I think Kagi was trying to keep that in mind as he was making his calculations.
Well, when you guys work on the budget, and you are the chair of finance committee, so you're very concerned with that. Do you think about the fact that, like, on the state level, the graduated income tax didn't pass, and so we've heard the lieutenant governor warn us that our tax, well, even the governor's warned us that it looks like we're going to get a tax increase. Do you guys isolate in the sort of the city vacuum, saying we have our own issues to worry about, or as part of your conversation, let's pay attention to what's happening at the state level? It looks like the county level, at least for Cook County, we're okay. Tony Preckwinkle seems to suggest we're not going to get hit there, but how does that work into your conversation and calculations?
Oh, absolutely. And it always has for me. I've always looked to see what types of changes we can make at the state level. So if it's reining in the TIF surplus that we've had, not the TIF surplus, but that's increased in the last 2 years with this mayor, but changing the way we look at TIF, changing what we call the assessments of not-for-profits, so what we call payment in lieu of taxes. A lot of our not-for-profits don't pay any taxes. And some of these changes can happen here in Chicago, but other ones like the sales tax modernization or what would have been the graduated income tax, those have to happen at the state level. And another big one is the local government distributive tax. Sounds like a long word, but it's basically the income tax that everybody pays to the state and then they send it back to the city. That amount was reduced by 4%, I think, under Governor Rauner. And it's never gone back up. And every suburb, every city in Illinois is asking for that amount to come back to their particular town or village or city. And it's just not happening. So we're all looking for ways to bring that revenue back to our towns and our cities so that we can close these budget gaps.
We do have some questions coming in. For the sake of our time, because we're limited, I'm going to just pose them for our listeners. So Al from Ravenswood, I know you're listening in. And Al wants to ask you, are you all considering a city income tax?
That has been on the table. There's several aldermen who proposed it. But I think that a lot of those types of taxes or fees have to go through pretty substantive hearings. We've got SSAs that pop up. I'm very cognizant of those doing damage to the property tax base. And so we want to have robust hearings before anything like that comes up.
Redistricting is around the corner. You and I have talked about that before, even some of our conversations where we were just chatting. It's looking, I'm seeing some new numbers here. Illinois actually could lose two congressional seats. But what is your sense of, your relationship with Mayor Emanuel led to a certain kind of districting for the 32nd Ward. What is your sense of how things will look in the next redistricting now based on how populations have shifted?
Well, it's going to be interesting. If you live along the lakefront, your wards don't change too much because, you can't go east. Everything goes either west or north and south. So I think the important thing to hear is look at wards to be drawn in a contiguous way where there's population, use the river, use the highway. And last time what we saw was just this you know, horrendous approach to doing redistricting, where it was pretty clear it was more politically driven than anything. A lot of you know what the gerrymandered fourth congressional district looks like, or the second ward of the city. And it doesn't help any constituent. It doesn't help businesses. It doesn't help residents to have a ward that stretches for miles and miles in a long sliver that doesn't create any continuity for neighborhoods or communities. And that's got to change this time around. It was unfortunate that, you know, the group of people that really pushed that through last time, we had Ed Burke, Dick Mell, the mayor, and a couple others who really kind of managed that. This time around, we really have to focus on a more fair and efficient way of drawing lines.
Yeah, I have so much.
And transparent.
Yeah, I have so much more I'd love to ask you about that. And that's, of course, a process that's going to be happening over the coming months. But for now, I'm going to say, yep. Alderman Scott Waggis, back of the 32nd Ward, I wish you and your family a very happy holiday season. Thank you for your time here, and you stay safe.
Thank you to all your listeners as well, and to you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.